Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this, our annual lecture of the Centre for English Legal History. It's a great pleasure that we have Suzanne Brand here today to give us this lecture. Suzanne is an independent scholar who studied in Berlin, and therefore, in the tradition of Maitland, can unite German and English legal history, unlike most of us. She works primarily on the 15th century, I think, which the period I regard as the real dark age of English legal history. I've never understood a thing that's happening in the 15th century. She also has a distinction, I think just about unique in this university, of having her unpublished work regularly referred to when we're teaching our students. I think that's a great accolade, Suzanne. But we are most beneficiaries of her in a different way. She's been one of the moving spirits behind the Anglo-American Legal Tradition website, the website that so many of us use on a daily basis, saving us from having to travel to Kew every day. And we're immensely grateful to you for that, Suzanne. That really has been just such a boon to legal historians the world over.
I've been benefiting from it every single day.
Sure you do. Anyway, so Suzanne will be talking today about outlaw and its consequences in later medieval English law and practice.
Thank you, Suzanne. Outlawry was a formally declared status which placed a person outside the law. It arose from the person being suspected of having committed a crime and then deliberately and persistently disregarding the legal process by taking flight. It was not only the most coercive procedure available, but also an indication of the limitations of law enforcement, given that it relied heavily on social pressure. After all, harsh penalties were suffered by those who willingly supported an outlaw. While harboring one for one night was just about acceptable, harboring him for two nights or more caused problems, and knowingly receiving or associating with an outlaw was punishable by death. However, sometimes this penalty was mitigated, as in the case of Nigel Hawthorne, who sheltered his two outlaw sons in the 1220s. He was spared his life, but only because he was old and fragile, though he still had to find good surety to be able to remain in his community. It was a bit different when Geoffrey de Wiganhale in 1285 sheltered his son Robert, who had not yet been outlawed, but whom he knew to be a thief. This father was remanded in custody because the son's outlawry procedure had started, probably putting additional pressure on the son to return and face justice, provided, of course, he was aware of his father's fate. While social pressure was a main tool of outlawry, effective law enforcement should not only be seen in terms of arrests and convictions, but also in terms of the detection of crime, identification of criminals, and exclusion of those identified from the local communities, as Henry Summerson has argued. And in this sense, outlawry was effective because of the severe penalties suffered by those who willingly provided support for an outlaw, making it unlikely that they would dare to come back to their local community. However, it could be argued that this simply shifted the problem to another county. There must have been a certain amount of movement of fugitives between counties, and this made the problem of crime worse, as was addressed in a statute in 1331, where it was claimed that, quote, such felonious persons indicted and outlawed have been encouraged in the mischief because they may not be attached in another county. This take is actually surprising because there was a way around this, as the case of Robert Batchelor shows, who was appealed of rape. He was outlawed in Yorkshire in 1322. When the justices were informed that he had lands and goods in Warwickshire and that he was lurking around Warwickshire and Worcestershire, the capias writs were sent to sheriffs of both counties to arrest him. Still, outlawry as part of the system of detection, identification, and exclusion was a penalty in itself, with far-reaching consequences, not just for the outlaw, but also for his immediate family. In 1230, for instance, Agnes, widow of Walter de Westler, was said to have lost her dower because of the outlawry of her late husband. In 1268, The assumption was that a daughter was incapable of being her mother's heir because her father had been outlawed for contumacy. And in 1277, two daughters of an outlawed felon brought a mort ancestor, secured an assize verdict in their favor, and were put in season by judicial writ. When they were ejected through a writ of novel disseisin, the defendants denied the validity of the assize verdict in the prelate's favor because they had not mentioned that their father had been outlawed. Initially, the crime which could lead to outlawry had to be a felony. Bracton, Fleeter, as well as Britain all agreed on this, although Bracton already recognized that outlawry for trespass via damis was acceptable, something which was later confirmed by statute in 1344, which also made it clear that nobody should be outlawed on an indictment for trespass which was not against the peace. A case of trespass via damis from 1305, which was brought to my attention recently by Paul, saw the outlawry procedure starting against a woman and her children to the point where the children surrendered to prison to avoid being outlawed. The case was dismissed by the justices because the children were of such a tender age that they could not possibly have committed a violent trespass and thus should not have been put in exigence at all. The plaintiff's attorney, who happened to be the father of the plaintiff, was taken into custody for going after mother and children out of malice. Outlawry for a felony was more common than outlawry for trespass via damis in the 13th century. This scenario has changed by the 14th century and especially the 15th century, as the slide shows, where you have the numbers of all civil and criminal outlaws found in the controlment rolls between 1400 and 1403 on the left side, and the numbers of review cases for outlawry on the same period on the right side. By then, of course, outlawry was possible in many more civil cases, which may explain the difference. For outlawry to happen, a connection was required between a crime and a flight in terms of a timeline. The flight had to have happened immediately after the fact, and that alone seemed to have tied the fugitive to the crime and made him a suspect, despite the fact that there might not have been any other circumstantial evidence of guilt. His action, that is his flight, was evidence of his guilty mind. While the reasoning is understandable, there are occasions when someone absconded despite not being guilty of felony, like Robert Manning, who had fled the county of Norfolk after Hugh, son of Walter Fleary, was killed on the 21st of May, 1327, during a fight. However, as the indictment made clear, Robert had acted in self-defense. And the fact that the indictment jury acknowledged this led to his surrender to court. And so it was right of the author of Bracton to caution in a different passage in the treatise that flight without contumacy did not justify outlawry. There also had to be someone who prosecutes, or at least an inquest before justices in heir before outlawry could be declared. Outlawry simply on the order of the king was not acceptable, and the landmark case seems to have been Hubert de Burgh's outlawry in 1234, which was declared void because there was no indictment and no appeal. The fugitive forfeited all his movable goods, such as stock, and all inanimate movables like household items or money owed on bonds. By the way, the list of goods and chattels of fugitives and felon households, which can be found in the exchequer records, give a good insight into the life of normally neglected because less visible group of people. I've started a new section on the world side of the ALT website, linking to documents listing the goods and chattels of fugitives and convicts, if anyone is interested. And this was a bit of an infomercial. Forfeiture for flight seems straightforward, but which day was important? Some exchequer documents, although not legal documents, differentiate between the suspect fleeing and the suspect withdrawing himself when dealing with forfeiture. The latter referring more clearly, it seems to me, to the outlawry procedure having been started. And it is this phrase we find in the plea rolls because it is what the late medieval juries mentioned when they found a suspect not guilty. It is always also mentioned that he did not withdraw himself. Exchequer documents often simply mention the day of his flight of an indicted felon without explaining how this was determined. When is a flight for forfeiture purposes? It is not always as easy to determine as in the case of Walter Philip, rector of Abbots Anne, who have killed Thomas Hayward in December 1390 and who fled to his church. His and one can assume that this happened immediately after the killing. The possessions he had on the day he fled to his church, which included a Roman law book worth half a mark, were forfeited, but it took 4 years for him to be outlawed. Occasionally, Exchequer documents provide an approximate date for the flight, around the Feast of St. Peter and Paul, for instance. While sometimes they are more precise, mentioning the day he was put into exigent for felony or simply the day of the felony as the relevant date. There seems to have been some tolerance in determining which day was important in regard to forfeiture, because the day he was put in exigent is clearly not identical with the day he committed the felony. However, there was no tolerance in terms of the outlawry procedure. Outlawry was normally done in the county court of the court of the county where the felony had happened. But county courts did not have a monopoly. Criminals who committed felonies in London were outlawed in the hustings. And in 1280, we have evidence that in appeals brought in the Borough of Southampton, outlawry procedure could start there, but it couldn't end there. Outlawry could only be declared before the itinerant justices. Another special area was the Cinque Ports, where John Lambert and others claimed in Michaelmas 1290 that they, as barons of the Cinque Ports, could only be outlawed in the Court of Shipway, the court held before the Lord Warden. But before outlawry could be declared, certain procedural steps had to be taken. First, the fugitive had to be informed of the charges against him. This was done by way of simple summons, ordering him to come and answer the charges. His legal status did not change at this time. It gave him the opportunity to present himself in court and clear his name. Only if he failed to appear was he to be exacted, and it is my impression that the return day of the summons should have been the date which determined the day of the flight for forfeiture purposes, in particular because the issue of the writ of exigent saw his legal status change. For instance, defendant who appeared in court after the outlaw procedure had been initiated had to find my appearance in trespass cases, even where this was not a norm. And in 1421, it was suggested in the yearbook report that in trespass, a defendant who came freely into court after the issue of an exigent should be allowed to appoint an attorney, implying that this was denied if he had been captured. The outlaw procedure required 4 sessions of the county court. Bracton asserted that county courts met monthly and thus gave the fugitive 5 months before he was declared an outlaw. But the treatise did not mention that outlawry could be declared as soon as the 4th, if no sureties for future appearance at the 5th county court was presented. And the bar was not set high. 1 mainpreneur per fugitive was sufficient. But it is impossible to say what connection, if any, those people who acted as sureties had to the fugitive, or how they ensured his appearance at the final county court, since we have their names only, no occupation and no place of residence. This kind of support of a fugitive was, of course, legal, but not without risk. If their protege did not appear at the 5th county court, they themselves would be in legal jeopardy, including being threatened with outlawry themselves. The monthly interval between county courts was important. In the late 13th and early 14th century, this already meant exactly 28 days in certain counties, and thus well before it became law by statute in the 16th century. In 1428, it was argued that the period between writs of exigent was not observed when the first step of the outlaw procedure happened on the 19th of February and the second on the 18th of March, an interval of 27 days. The missing day was a violation, it was claimed, of Magna Carta, as well as the customary law of Cornwall, which seems to have been particularly strict as it did not allow the period between county courts to be longer either. And the King's Bench agreed. It was probably for this reason that sheriffs had to include all the dates, normally given in relation to a saint's day, but sometimes a weekday together with a precise date, as well as all the locations of the county courts where exaction had taken place in their returns or face a fine. However, the individual stages in the outlaw procedure were not always noted on the plea rolls. Rather, the first and last stages, only with the steps in between summarized, or just the date of the last county court with reference made to the individual steps in the sheriff's return. And the justices occasionally had to ask for this information if the return failed to mention the dates and the locations. It seems that compliance with the minimum requirements could be used to challenge an outlawry, but only if the outlaw brought it up himself. It was not checked by the county courts nor by the king's justices ex officio. Magna Carta allowed the period between county courts to be longer if it was local custom, like in Lincolnshire and Yorkshire, for instance, where county courts met only every 6 weeks. Needless to say, the fugitive could give himself up at any stage during these 5 months. He could surrender to the sheriff in the county court, who then had to produce him on the day required. Only a very limited number of excuses were accepted. For instance, a good one was to say that the prisoner was lying in childbirth. But claiming that the prisoner was too ill to be produced was deemed insufficient in 1353, despite the fact that this excuse had been accepted earlier in 1319 and again in the 1320s. And the sheriff, who claimed that he could not present the prisoner for the lack of money and other necessities which are necessary in regard to safe conduct due to the short time available, did not impress the judges. If the fugitive surrendered directly to the Marshalsea prison, if the writ of exigent was issued by the King's Bench, or the Fleet prison, if it was issued by the Common Bench, he had then to ask for a supersedious writ to the county court to hold the outlawry procedure. It was a reasonably straightforward process. If the request was made out of term, Chancery would issue a supersedious to the sheriff with the requirement to take sureties, or could inform the sheriff that sureties had been found in Chancery. Not at all normal was what happened on the 3rd of May, 1305, when the fugitive Alexander Goldrow himself handed over the supersedious writ to the servant of a bailiff, who was a long way outside the bar, and asked him to hand it to the bailiff in order to deliver it to the sheriff and the coroners who were presiding over the Lincolnshire County Court. There was something obviously fishy about this, and it turned out that the writ, which was not in the normal form used in court, was a fake. The sheriff, who had accepted it, tried to shift the blame onto his predecessor. But because the sheriff could not deny that Alexander had shown up in his county court and that he had returned the fake supersedious together with the exigent, he was sent to prison. If a fugitive forgot to obtain a supersedious, the justices could still reverse the outlawry despite the fact that there was no fault in the process. The reasoning behind it was explained in a law report from 1325, namely that the law is more favorable to maintaining and saving than to punishing. It was not acceptable for a sheriff to take sureties from the fugitive who surrendered to him without instruction or to let them out of his custody without prior authorization. The sheriff of Lincolnshire allowed fugitives to leave prison as a favor and then maliciously filed a wrong return. That is to say, he didn't return the exigent at all, in order to delay justice for the king. He then blamed his return of writs, but the justices were not impressed and fined both. While these two were derelict of their duties, other sheriffs took their jobs more seriously, sometimes too seriously. The County Court of Kent, for instance, outlawed Robert Pomeroy of Newenden because the supersedious writ gave Newenham as his place of residence. Robert had indeed surrendered to the Marshalsea while the outlawry process was still running. And when the court received the sheriff's return in Trinity 1307, informing the justices that Robert had been outlawed, they decided that the supersedious, which was issued earlier, should have been honored despite the clerical error, and therefore annulled the outlawry without the need for Robert to purchase a writ of error. If the fugitive did not appear at the Fifth County Court after having provided a main turn at the Fourth, he was outlawed, as I mentioned before. However, there were a few acceptable excuses for non-appearance at the Fifth County Court. William the Carpenter of Finsbury in Kent and his wife Alice, for instance, were put in exigent in Kent for not paying a fine in a trespass suit in which they were found guilty. At the Fifth County Court, William appeared and after having produced a main burner at the Fourth, and he surrendered to prison. Aldus did not come and was outlawed. William paid a fine to the king and was then asked why his wife was not in court, to which he replied that she had been imprisoned for 3 days after having been in a fight with Susanna, the wife of John Wyatt, and therefore missed her required appearance at the Fifth County Court. Since it would have been unlawful to outlaw her if she was indeed incarcerated, a habeas corpus causa was issued to the constable of Rochester Castle to allow the justices to verify this claim. It could happen, though not very often, that county courts refused to outlaw suspects, for instance, when they thought to be not guilty. In one appeal of homicide, no outlawry was declared at the Fifth, at the Sixth, or even at the Seventh County Court. While there seems to have been a good reason for the refusal to outlaw the suspects, because when they finally appeared in court, the trial jury found them not guilty and named two other people as responsible for the homicide, the whole county was immersed because the law did not allow exceptions, nor did it allow county courts to decide matters of guilt or innocence. In another case, the outlawry at the Fifth County Court did not go ahead for a completely different reason, namely the death of the king. The court decided that this was an insufficient excuse and issued a fine. And in 1322, it was a Sussex coroner maliciously leaving the session at the Fifth County Court, which prevented the outlawries from going ahead. He had to answer for his dereliction of duty. Once outlawry was proclaimed, the legal status of the outlaw changed dramatically. He forfeited all his possessions, with the free lands being taken into the king's hands for a year and a day, and then reverting to the chief lord from whom it was held. All chattels went to the king for good. The king could waive his rights to the goods of outlaws, as did Edward III in his general pardon of 1377, or give it away, as Richard II did in 1390, to the abbot and convent of St. Mary's Abbey of Cirencester, and in March 1396 in a charter to the citizens of Worcester, albeit for a very limited group of outlaws. The outlaw lost his right to inherit, with all sales and gifts made by him after the felony invalidated. He could also no longer bring any lawsuits, although there was an exception for writs of error to reverse an outlawry. So how did the authorities keep track of who was outlawed? From 1339 until the end of Henry VI's reign, the king's attorney of the king's bench began to note inquiries into outlawry's goods on separate membranes of his controlment rolls, providing us with the names of the outlaw, the counties where the outlawry was pronounced, the date of the outlawry, and the plaintiff's name and the charge. For 1422 to 1483, we have this information included in two separate controlment rolls, but only for outlawries at the king's suit. In addition, we have lists of the names of kings of lists of the same kind of information, which originated in the two benches from the late 14th and early 15th century. And we know that in 1398, the Chief Justice of the Common Bench was told to send the names of outlaws to the Exchequer each term, rather than yearly, as before. On one occasion, the roll with the names of outlaws sent by Walter Clopton, Chief Justice of the King's Bench, on the 18th of November 1398, contained seven names of men, allegedly all outlawed on the same day in Lincoln, which should not have been on it, as the Chief Justice later certified. If an outlaw did not surrender, then the overall consensus was that he could be killed lawfully, especially if he resisted arrest. Bracton, Britton, and Fleeter agree on this, but it is unclear if the arrest attempt had to be made by people authorized to make an arrest or not. If we look at the evidence, there are indications that only certain officials might lawfully execute an outlaw. We know that in the late 12th century, 5 shillings was paid to sergeants for an outlaw's head. And while no prosecution followed if the killing occurred during a hue and cry, in 1328, Chief Justice Scope held that a lawful killing of an outlaw meant resisting arrest by a bailiff. The line was drawn, it seems, at helpers. A bailiff who was sent by the sheriff in 1355 to arrest an outlaw recruited his son, his sub-bailiff, and his servants to assist. The outlaw was killed by one of the servants. The coroner's roll reports that three of the people involved were acquitted, but the killer and the bailiff were not among them, and their fate is unfortunately unknown. If no official was involved, the process was clear. Those who killed outlaws had to stand trial. In 1235, for instance, Richard Le Horn brought an appeal against John de la Law, who had been outlawed for another deed. Richard did not bother to pursue his lawsuit, but instead decided to kill John de la Law. However, this recruited in him being outlawed himself. Beckton acknowledged that an outlaw should not be killed after being arrested, while conceding that there might be good reasons, which were not specified, which would excuse such action, and that the local custom in Herefordshire and Gloucestershire near the Welsh marches allowed such a killing. So this was a bit of a gray area, even in Bracton's time. And it may not come to as a surprise that the justices had to deal with killings of outlaws by members of the public in later years. In 1328, Henry, son of Roger of Clitheroe, and his servant John Page, and multiple unknown others, were indicted for the killing of Peter the Tailor of Preston. They had dragged Peter out of his house, taken him to Longwich in Blackburn Hundred, and killed him there. Henry asked whether he needed to answer because Peter had been outlawed for the death of Roger the Mersey in Middlesex at the suit of the victim's son, but also pleaded benefit of clergy to be on the safe side if this exception was not allowed. Now, this was clearly not a killing of an outlaw while resisting arrest. And yet the justices of the King's Bench wanted only to be certain that Peter the Tailor had not received a pardon for the outlawry before he was killed. As there was no trace of it, Henry was dismissed without a day, despite the Chief Justice Scope stating in a law report of this case that, quote, even if a man were outside the law, on account of this, a man could not kill him, something that another Chief Justice, Sherasol, seemed to agree with in a case before him in 1353, where a knight, appealed by a widow of killing her husband, argued that the victim had been outlawed for felony. Sherasol remarked that someone could kill an outlaw feloniously just as like any other man. The enrollment of the case does not mention this detail. It just notes that James de Holville, who was accused of having killed Nicholas Burrell feloniously on the 11th of September 1353, had simply pleaded not guilty. We know that the killing was unjustified because Nicholas had indeed received a pardon of the king's suit for the death of Alexander of Ireland, for which he had been outlawed. That meant he was no longer an outlaw when he was killed by James in the King's Highway in Norfolk. However, Sherasol was probably trying to make a more general point, because he still referred to Alexander as an outlaw, namely that nobody could know the status of an outlaw at any given time. The outcome was that James himself needed a pardon for the felonious killing of Nicholas, which he received on the 28th of April, 1355. Now, Sherasol's opinion seems never to have made it into common knowledge, because almost 40 years later, on the 27th of August, 1391, William Pike arrested Simon Gelder with the help of others. Simon, who had been outlawed for felony in Lincolnshire, was then beheaded in a place called Plain Place. William believed that he had acted lawfully in executing someone outlawed for felony. However, all were indicted 4 years later and produced individual pardons in Easter Term 1397. So even if the outlaw was not killed during or shortly after having been apprehended, he had lost his legal standing and protection and was treated like a convicted felon despite not having been convicted of the deed which got him outlawed in the first place. This was because the failure to appear in court carried the presumption of guilt strong enough to justify suffering the consequences of being declared a felon. In 1221, Robert of Ickleham, arrested for being of ill fame, was said to have been outlawed in Sussex, which he denied. But since it was shown that he had indeed been outlawed by order of the justices of the air, he was hanged. And the same happened in another case in 1248 at the Sussex Air. Given the serious consequences of outlawry, it should not surprise us that the process was sometimes misused to settle personal grievances. Bracton already recognized this. The treatise has a specimen writ for pardon for outlawry for a person who was appealed in York. While this appeal was pending, he was accused of the same deed in Essex and was outlawed there. The king pardoned this outlawry because it was assumed that he probably did not know about the outlawry procedure having started in Essex, especially since he had been acquitted in the York lawsuit. By 1311, this kind of misuse had been frequent enough, or it had affected the high and mighty, that the ordainers put a clause into the ordinances issued that year, which had not hitherto received much attention. Clause 35 ruled that those who sued malicious suits against defendants who held lands were either made to abjure the realm or be put in exigent and outlawed themselves if they could not be found. The way this malicious act allegedly worked was to accuse a person wrongly of a felony or a trespass in a county where they did not have any lands or tenements. Such outlaws were not in future to be put to death if they were disinherited if accused of a felony, provided they surrendered to the royal prison and acquitted themselves in the county where they had been outlawed. The part of the clause referring to felonies is puzzling, I think, as there was no distraint available in those cases. So why was it important that the outlaws had lands and tenements in counties where they were outlaws? Should we read lands and tenements as the equivalent of residing in that county? This would actually make sense, as people most likely might not have been aware of outlawry procedures in counties in which they didn't live or in which they did not do any business. So let's look at a court case involved in Easter term 1320, which mentions the ordinance. Michael Le Petit and his sons, conveniently called John and John, as well as Lawrence de Beauville, were outlawed in Cumberland on a robbery appeal brought by Robert de Sutton on the 31st of July, 1319. The court ordered an inquiry into their goods and chattels, lands and tenements. And because it was testified in court that they had left the county and were wandering around Cornwall, the sheriff of Cornwall was ordered to arrest them, which he did. When they appeared in court in Easter term 1320 and were asked why judgment against them for their outlawry should not be pronounced, they said that they were maliciously outlawed in Cumberland and that they had enough land in Cornwall by which they could have been compelled to answer Roger. They then asked that they be helped according to the form of the ordinances recently provided for such a case. A royal writ dated 18th of February 1320 then followed, which cited chapter 35, but only referred to the felony passage. A scarifacius writ was sent out to summon the original plaintiff to appear in Trinity term 1320, and the outlaws were released on main price corpus corpore after a brief spell in the Marshalsea prison. When the sheriff and coroner of Cumberland returned that no indictment or appeal could be found, Michael and his sons were dismissed without a day. In Trinity term 1320, this case was again enrolled in the plea rolls and copied verbatim until the moment Michael and his sons appeared in court in the custody of the sheriff of Cornwall. Then the entry changes dramatically. The reference to chapter 35 of the ordinance and the royal writ were left out. Instead, Michael argued that the original appeal was brought in Hilary term 1317 and that the sheriff had returned, that pledges of prosecution had been presented, but that the accused could not be found and had nothing by which they could be attached. However, there was no trace of this return, neither in the rolls nor on the doors of the original writ. Therefore, it was argued the suit was discontinued and any judicial writs issued thereafter were without warrant. The original plaintiff, who had been notified by Scarifacius, did not appear, and so it was left to the justices to decide. The argument was accepted, and after diligent search to check if Michael and his sons had been indicted or appealed in Cumberland, which they weren't, the outlawries were annulled, and Michael and his sons were dismissed without a day. Nothing seems to have happened to the original plaintiff, Roger. But Chapter 35 of the ordinance also dealt with trespass cases involving land, tenants of lands, and we have evidence of it being applied. Henry Grubb and William the Baker were outlawed in Kent by virtue of a trespass suit brought by Agnes of Coventry. They surrendered to the Marshalsea and declared that they had been living in Somerset at the time the first exigent was issued and when outlawry was declared, that they did not know about the lawsuit, and that they had enough property in Somerset by which they could have been attached, and that they were prepared to answer Agnes' accusation. Agnes was summoned together with the Somerset jury, the latter confirming what Henry and William had said. By Easter term 1317, it was clear that Agnes had died, but judgment against Henry and William was adjourned until Easter term 1319, when the case unfortunately disappears from the record. A few years later, we have another victim. In 1320, Edward the Holt, who had been accused of a trespass in Sussex, had plenty of property in Dorset, but none in Sussex. And he was outlawed on the 8th of November, 1319, without being aware of it. He received a pardon of the outlawry, which is not the same as an outlawry being declared void. The ordinance of 1311 was, of course, repealed in 1322, but the problem persisted. Still, it took more than a century before another attempt to stop this kind of misuse was made. A statute of 1426, enacted because of complaints by the Commons in Parliament in regard to suspicious indictments which had led to outlawries, required capious writs to be sent both to the sheriff of the county in which the indictments were made, as well as the county in which the accused were meant to be residing, with the return day being at least 6 weeks later. This provision was confirmed 3 years later in another statute which dealt with appeals and required that a second capias be sent after the return of the first, this one to the county in which the suspects were dwelling. The second capias was to contain an order to the sheriff that if fugitives could not be found, proclamation was to be made in two county courts before the return day of the writ, thus allowing more time for them to show up. Only if this failed could a writ of exigent be issued. Outlawries which did not follow these directives were declared void. Special arrangements of similar sort had already been made in 1399 for Cheshire and in 1421 for Lancashire. Bracton tells us that when one has been outlawed, no matter in what way and regardless of the cause, it will not be safe for him to appear unless and until he has been inlawed by the grace of the prince. Bracton mentions two ways of being restored to the king's peace after outlawry was proclaimed, depending on whether the outlawry was done properly, in which case the king could pardon the outlaw, or whether it was done contrary to the law, in which case the outlawry needed to be declared void. If outlawry was done properly, whether for just cause or not, the pardoned outlaw was restored to the peace only. He would not get his chattels back because of his flight, nor is in his inheritance because the outlawry had been done properly. But he was allowed to enter into new contracts while old ones remained invalid, because the king could not grant grace if it was to the harm and damage of others. Which is why a pardon is conditional on the outlaw surrendering to prison and answering the original plea, which got him outlawed in the first place, because he could not be before he could be restituted. If the outlawry was not done properly, the outlaw was to be restored to everything as though he had never been outlawed, without the need of a pardon. This was, of course, the preferred outcome and may explain why William de Withyford, although having secured a pardon for his outlawry in a debt case, still tried to prove an error in process in 1366. He pointed out that he was called Witchyford in the original writ and three judicial writs, but Withyford, with a T instead of a C, in the writ of exigent. However, this argument was not deemed substantial enough to justify his request. So, One way to challenge an improper outlawry was by writ of error. It was usually based on a complaint made by the person harmed, but could also be obtained by friends and others, which normally meant relatives, on his behalf. The writ was issued in the form of a letter closed out of the king's chancery, attested in the name of the king, and addressed to the chief justice the chief justice and his associates of the court, which had issued the writs of exigence. It was returnable into the king's bench, and it authorized the justices of the king's bench to inspect the record and process of the outlawry and to do what was legally required according to the laws and customs of the realm. The next stage in proceedings was the appearance of the outlaw in court on his own accord and his voluntary transfer to the custody of the marshal. He was then to plead in person, claiming that the procedure which led to his outlawry contained one or more errors, sometimes listing them at this stage, and asking for the annulment of the outlawry. Errors in process could be listed now because they were decided by the justices without the need of the original plaintiff to be present in court. The outlaw had to plead in person unless he was ill and it was attested, in which case he could appoint an attorney, as was made clear in a statute in 1406. What then followed was the issue of a scirifacius writ for the original plaintiff, whose suit had led to the outlawry. It was returnable in the same or the next term. The outlaw would then list the alleged errors again. It is at this point where errors of fact were named, and which the original plaintiff could dispute, at which point the issue would go to a jury. Now, how often did this happen? How often were writs of error brought in to annul an outlawry? Let's look at some figures. The first two decades of the 14th century saw 191 review cases in the King's Bench, but only two concerned mistakes made in outlawries. This had changed dramatically by the first two decades of the 15th century, when there were 673 cases, 431 of which were about errors made in outlawry procedures. Errors occurred mainly in debt cases, followed by trespass, detainer of charge and chattels, account, and the violation of the statute of laborers, or the illegal rescue of the course, that is, in civil outlawry. The number of error cases for felony and rebellion was very small in comparison, which might indicate that more attention and care was paid to following the rules in criminal outlawry. The main errors claimed were errors in process, as when the plaintiff in the original suit had appeared by attorney according to the record, although no warrant of attorney could be found. This was used in 110 cases. 69 times, not all of the three required capias writs had been returned by the sheriff before the first writ of exigent was issued. Less often, the outlaw had received a supersedius, which was ignored. And occasionally, we have violations of the statute of additions of 1413, which were mentioned, although this number may be low because it was only available for 6 years of my sample. Mistakes made in the writ of exigent itself or in the sheriff's return were rarely cited. By the way, this is not a complete list. I could also mention variations in the names, variations in the sum of the debt, or lawsuits which disappeared from the record sometime during the main process only to appear at a later stage with the issue of an exigent and so on. Errors of fact were also alleged less often, like claiming to have been in the king's service. When Simon Turkel alleged this after he was outlawed in Essex in an appeal of homicide brought by the widow of the deceased on the 7th of November 1400, he not only had a writ of error, but also the certification of his service and a royal writ instructing the justices to take notice of this. On 18 occasions, the outlaw pointed out that he had been imprisoned during the outlawry process. The king's attorney would take the place of the original plaintiff if he chose not to appear, arguing that the outlaw had been at large, and then the issue would go to a jury. In 7 instances, the plaintiff in the original lawsuit had died before the outlawry was proclaimed. He was still summoned, nonetheless, and when he did not appear, surprisingly, the king's attorney once again stepped in, arguing it reverse, and the jury decided the issue. Twice an error of law was made, when outlawry was proclaimed in cases where no outlawry was available, like in the Sumsit, or where a violation of the statute regarding restriction of the admiral and his deputy was claimed. Two cases seemed to be especially interesting because the suit was started in one county while the outlawry happened in another, a scenario vaguely reminiscent of the problem addressed in the 1311 ordinance. So let's look at one of the cases. Christina, widow of William Guy, was sued in 1412 in Wiltshire for detainy of chattels. But she was outlawed in Somerset after it was attested in court that she was lurking in Somerset. She later claimed successfully that the outlawry in Somerset was not based on an original writ and should therefore be annulled. The only time writs of error were not successful was when the outlaw did not show up in court. This happened three times. But why would an outlaw do that? Well, one was in the custody of the king's French marshal and may not have had a say in it. The other two were out on main prize when they were defaulted. And it is possible that they may have been captured while on the way to court, like William Medrays, a London brewer who was on his way to Westminster in order to get a pardon for his outlawry at the suit of brought by Thomas Chappell, a fellow brewer. William was arrested by the same Thomas. Since an outlaw still enjoyed the privilege of the court regarding protection from arrest while on his way to court, William received his pardon. And we can assume that this scenario could also happen if someone was traveling to Westminster to sue a writ of error. Outlawry could be annulled without a writ of error if the outlawry insisted that there was no original writ, and thus all the judicial writs issued thereafter were without warrant, or by pleading benefit of clergy, as was done successfully by William Gerberg in 1305 and John Austin in 1398, and as a precaution by Henry, son of Roger Clitheroe, in 1328, as we have heard earlier. Indeed, benefit of clergy could still be claimed after an unsuccessful writ of error. Another option was to claim mistaken identity, though this did not happen very often in the early 15th century. However, not all sheriffs were as cautious as the Sheriff of Kent, who was sent to arrest William at a castle, outlawed for trespass in 1322. The sheriff returned that there were three William at a castles residing in his county, and he didn't know whom to arrest, so he did nothing. If the wrong person got outlawed, he could then either show up in court, explain who he was with the original plaintiff present, who would then ask to confirm or deny what was said, as in the case in Easter Term 1322. In the case 2 years later, a certiorari writ was sent to the sheriff and coroner for the record of the outlawry, followed by a writ of indemnitate nominis to the justices of the King's Bench, in which the mistaken identity was addressed at the justices' order to do right, again with the original plaintiff present in court. A statute of 1363, which was concerned with claims of mistaken identity, allowed sureties to be found in order to prevent goods and chattels of people who were wrongly outlawed to be taken into the king's hands. A rather unusual way was to petition Parliament. Thomas Clare of Oxford did this in the November Parliament of 1417, explaining that he had been maliciously indicted and outlawed for theft, that the indictment had been tampered with, and that the outlawry procedure was flawed. All the people involved, from the jurors who indicted to the sheriffs and the coroners of the county court where the outlawry was proclaimed, were questioned under oath. One coroner testified that he had been present at the fourth county court, but none of the earlier ones, but that Thomas Clare was not exacted at the fourth. At least, he didn't hear him being exacted. Another coroner said that he was present at all county courts, but that he did not hear Thomas being exacted. However, he was told by one of his servants that Thomas had been exacted. Yet another coroner said that he was the only coroner present at the fourth county court and that he heard Thomas being exacted. A fourth coroner,
said that he had no clue as he had been present at any of the county courts. At this stage, the justices had heard enough and decided to dismiss Thomas Clare without a day, without, however, explicitly declaring his outlawry void. Civil outlawry procedure followed the same rules as criminal outlawry, but the consequences were less severe, as there was no loss of life, just incarceration, and no loss of land. It is astonishing, I think, that it was never explicitly stated anywhere that the penalty for civil outlawry was different from the one for criminal outlawry. It is only in legislation like the ordinances mentioned earlier, or in the outcome of lawsuits, that it becomes obvious that there must have been a difference. It is equally surprising that they did not come up with a special name for civil outlawry in the Middle Ages, given that they had a special name for outlawry for women. If civil outlawry was done lawfully, a pardon was still needed, and this included, from 1331 onwards, a requirement to answer the original plea as if no outlawry had taken place. The outlaw would be released on surety until that happened, but should he then fail to attend his day in court, arrest warrants were issued for him and his main prisoners. And if the attorney of a plaintiff who had sued had led to an outlawry because the defendant did not pay the fine due to the king, informed the court that his client had not been satisfied in regard to the damages awarded by the jury, the main prisoners had to be found who would then pay if the pardoned outlaw failed to do so. And we can see how this would have helped to persuade or encourage reluctant debtors to pay out. If the main aim of the common law was to ensure that no wrongdoing went unpunished, because everyone in the realm is or ought to be obedient to the Lord King and his peace, civil and criminal outlawry was certainly a potent tool. Being an outlaw, even in civil cases, was stressful. The merchant Richard Rick of Salisbury, who was outlawed at the suit of Thomas Crook in a plea of debt, was captured on a capias ut legatum, but then released only to threaten Thomas with death, which of course did not help him. Moreover, if there was a risk that an outlaw felon had, there was a risk that an outlawed felon had nothing to lose, as John Slingsby made clear in 1468 to Brian Rowcliffe, Baron of the Exchequer, when he threatened him that if he be outlawed, he shall play the outlaw as did Robin Hood and slee the said Brian. And now that I have mentioned Robin Hood, I can safely end this paper. Thank you very much.